We have very limited time. From experience last night, we had just about an hour. That's, you know, and that's about what we have now. It's about an hour. So we'll miss the first lunch, but we'll make the second lunch. Okay, and but now, first of all, before I start, I just wanted to suggest to you some topical areas which you may be interested in. And last night was a little more of a cultural thing, where, you know, I did some singing and I taught a song, and maybe we can do that again today. But my topic area and the choices are something like this. Number one, a little touch into my childhood. You know, it's kind of like an autobiography kind of thing. That could we sit in a circle here, right here? We could sit in a circle rather than to be outside the circle. Try to get into the circle right here, if you will. Into the circle. A lot of chairs up here. Okay. And of course, the reason for that is that we want everybody involved in an equal way, and everybody's kind of equal. So, you know, that's kind of the Indian way, and so we don't want somebody way back somewhere, and maybe they're not equal or something. So the first choice is that I can relate a little bit into my childhood and tell you a little bit about the life as I remember it at reservation. And so you get a taste of that, maybe. And secondly, I can do is I've been with Indian work for over 20 years, primarily in the Twin City area. And what I could do there is I can describe to you what it's like to visit a home in Minneapolis, let's say, or St. Paul. That's the second thing I could do. I could give you experiences, tell you about it. The third thing I could do is I could concentrate education. Now, I was the director of Indian education in Minnesota for over 2 years. So I could spend the whole period on education alone and about the problems that kids are having and the relationships of people, you know, in educating, you know, Indian kids and so forth. I could do that, see. Or I could deal with issues, you know, that you think maybe I ought to be dealing with within this hour. In addition to that, I just want to get into the drum a little bit so that we can feel it once again to understand some of the basis, like I explained last night. So, but before we do it, would you want to come into the circle? We want people to come right up in, so we're not clustered and cluttered. Everybody in the circle. So, now, first of all, I just want to ask you your preference. Can I just have you speak up a little bit? And, yeah. Okay, let me just suggest then that what you're saying is that maybe I ought to spend some time just discussing questions like that. And then we'll have a little discussion about it. Yeah, we can do that. No, that's a very good question. No, that's very good, and it's important. And I think that, you know, if you would like, I could spend a little time talking a little bit about that, you know. Okay, that's one idea. Are there some other ideas about, yeah?
You were asking about which idea you should work on first. I was just wondering how many sessions are you going to have?
This week, you know, I had the one, and it was kind of introductory. It was just talk about the cultural basis. I'm going to refer back to it every time I speak, because it's still very central. And there will be new people coming in, so I really should go through that a little bit, you know, that cultural aspect. But then, you see, this week, now this is the second time I will speak this week, and the third time apparently is Saturday night, when I'm going to teach some dancing, using the drum and to just actually help you to understand, participate a little bit more, understand a little bit more, and have some fun. Sometimes you get so enthused that you want to do it on and on, but I'll do what I can, you know, as long as my voice will hold out. You know. So, but that's the plan for this week. Apparently, on Sunday, Holden staff normally gets together. And then they look at the week ahead, and let's see what we're going to do. And at that time, apparently, we're all going to be considering what we can do for the following week. We should know then Monday morning, kind of, what's happening for the following week. At the end of next week, then I leave. So it really does give me a chance to share some of this, you know, at least in a little bit. Could you come into the circle? Okay, a little more discussion. Now, there are some issues here, so I'll concentrate on that. Yeah.
I'm back on the reservation.
Okay, back on the reservation. That's two things. Other kinds of things that you might like me to deal on a little bit.
Experiences in the home. So.
Okay, there's three. Any other thoughts about what we should do?
You work great deal in the Twin Cities.
Yeah. I think that's the same as the visiting, isn't it? She suggested I talk about the visiting. But my visiting was in the Twin Cities. So will that take care of your question too? Oh, I see. Yeah, we can talk about that.
Well,
yeah.
It sounds like enough for 1 hour.
Yeah.
I would be very interested in what's happening to ours.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful
work. Okay.
Now,
we're going to just kind of mess around for until about 12 or so, and then we'll get started. We'll try to get the song started and everything. To start everything, it's a spiritual place, you know, this Holden. And as I did last night, I always like to refer back to this little spiritual message, which I'll kind of involve ourselves each time we do this. So I'll go through this once again. But before we do, I'd like to find three people again, just like last night, that might like to kind of try to sing the song, and I'll teach the song. And you sang before, so let's try to get another one, unless there's no one else.
These two. Do you sing?
Okay, you. There's two. And one of you? Well, there's two. You want to sing this one? Okay. Why don't I just make some remarks first, and then we'll try to sing the song. And we'll start with that song, and then we'll end with it. And last night, we called ourselves the Niji Singers. So when I call for the Niji Singers, then they come up and we'll try to learn the song, okay? Okay, then I want to just make some remarks about this drum. It's kind of a spiritual thing. Actually, there are three things that are very, very important to the Indian people. And one of those things is spirit. And among the Chippewas, we call it Gitche Manitou. Gitche Manitou is God. And as I remarked last night, you've taken the word God in our general society, and it has become a profanity. People have abused it. And we don't want that, of course. Among the Indian people, among the Chippewas, they use Gitche Manitou. They have never abused that word. They have never used it in an irreverent way. Whenever they've mentioned it, it's been in an air of reverence as such. So that, now, what has that got to do with the drum? See? Well, really, when you use the drum, see, you've got to sing a song. See, and when you sing the song, then you see, where do you get it? See, some of the Indian people like to go off by themselves, you know, like this would be an ideal place to pick up a song. See, because you can go back into the mountains, and you can hear the wind in the trees, and you can sit down, and you've got to have a vision. You've got to have an idea that comes to you. And so with the spirit. Your spirit, you take that spirit up on the mountain, and then suddenly you want to be receptive, you know, a little bit. So you're receptive, and suddenly a song occurs to you that you'd like to try. And you try it out up on the mountain, all by yourself. And you bring it back. So the song itself is actually inspired. It's a vision, really, that you've sought and you've got it. You got a brand new song now, and it sounds kind of good, see, because it fits into the environment around here. And you can make a whole song out of this, see, an Indian song. That is the spirit. It is part of the drumming, see. So that whenever we talk about it, then, you see, it's a spiritual thing we're doing. I remember my dad died about a year ago. And I ended up, and I just want to tell the story about my dad. Of course, I'm full-blood Chippewa, see. And Chippewas are from, from Michigan and southern Canada and Minnesota and upper Michigan, you know, and North Dakota, and that area generally. That's where the Chippewas are from. And my dad, of course, I'm full-blood, so my dad is Indian. He's Ogimarup is his name. And my name is Shawinimides, which pertains to a spirit bird from the south. And there's another whole thing about the naming ceremonies, which I shared last night, which I'm glad to talk to other people about too. But it's a spiritual thing again. That when you're about 1 year old, you're being given a name by a guardian that is one of the older people who would like to give our little kid a name. See, and I was this little kid, and I got a name, and that's what I got. Now, the spirit of the South is very strong, because when you think of the South, you think of the summer. See, what happens in the summer? In the summer, things start to grow. All the roots take buds and they come up. You know, the whole power of growth is the south. Shawin is the south. See? So that when you talk about the south direction, you're talking about a power that's very powerful. It makes things grow. And that name was given to me, Shawin Ibanez, so that's my name. Well, anyway, my dad practiced the Indian religion. And now, I was on this farm at eight years old, between 8 and 9 years old. I was taken off the reservation and put on the farm. It happened to be a Norwegian farm. And before that time, I was into it a lot more. And I began to understand a lot more. But they pulled me away and they plunked me into this farm community. And so I kind of lost the language. I am able to talk a lot of I'm able to understand the feelings and everything, you know, of the Indian community. But I've been pulled away from it. So about a year ago, my dad died. And I'm the oldest in our family. I'm the oldest boy. And my brother Billy is 2 years younger, and my sister Linda is 2 years younger than him. And so I received this long distance call as my dad passed away. He was 82, I think he was. And he was in a rest home. And he died rather quickly, so it was really very fast and everything. And they asked me a number of questions during that time. And one of the key questions they asked me, now this is very, very pertinent to me. What do you want? Do you want a Christian ceremony, service, or do you want an Indian service? Now that's a very good question. See? Now I'm Christian, but here's my dad, see, who has never been Christian, but he followed the Indian religion. See? So I thought about that for a little while, and I thought that the only thing I could do, the only answer that I could give, because I love my dad, see, was the fact that he's got to have an Indian ceremony. That's it. That's to honor him. See, in all the life he lived, that's the only way. Now see, you know, when I was taken away from the reservation, I was a small boy between 8 and 9 years old. So I had not been acquainted with what you should do at a situation like that. So I became quite concerned that, you know, I want to honor my dad. I don't want to make a mockery of anything. This has got to be good and right. So what I ended up was talking to a holy man, a Chippewa holy man. And I went up to him and gave him a gift. And we talked. And that's how you start things, you see. You talk for maybe an hour, maybe more. And you begin to feel out, you know, what is right about a person, you know. And even we, you know, if we were to talk, you could kind of sense the goodness flowing. Or maybe you couldn't. But at least in this case, you know, when I talked to this older man, I could sense a goodness flowing. You know, when we're talking about things in general. But I asked him pointedly. I said, now listen, I said, my dad is Indian. I want to do right by him. I want to know what I should do. And he was in full sympathy. And it was like he was my older brother. He was kind, and he understood death immediately. And he advised me. He said, what you have to do is to, first of all, he backed up. He said, what clan is he? Well, I didn't know at that time. I really didn't know. There's five clans that we are, our Indian people are of. And so I kind of thought about it a bit, and I said, I don't know. I think we're related to the Bear Clan, but, you know, really, I don't know. And then he said, well, it doesn't matter. And again, he came with a kindness, see, that was very, you know, very characteristic of some of our people. And he said, listen, he said, it doesn't really matter. What you need to do is to get two things. First of all, what you got to have is a amigus shell. Amigus shell. Now, that's Indian. Amigus shell is actually, you've seen these little cowrie shells that you can buy in some of these gift shops and so forth. Some of them are really tiny like that, and then some of them are big. Some of them are kind of really big, you know. A cowrie shell. What you got to do is get one of those shells and take it along to the wake, see. And also, while you're about it, what you ought to do is to go and get a weasel skin, see. And here I was, you know, listening to all this, you know, a weasel skin, you know. And I said, well, now, where am I going to get a weasel skin, you know. And then he's an old man. He said, well, you can get one down at the dime store, he says. Well, of course, you know, I went to the nearest dime store, went up to the clerk, and I said, hey, I want a weasel skin. And they were, you know, they were just laughing at me, just wondering, well, where do you get a, we don't sell any weasel skins around. And I didn't know what to think, you know. And I said, do you have a amigus shell? And of course, she didn't know what that was either. And I felt kind of bad. Now, I got to go to the wake now without anything. Finally, you know, I've met an Indian friend who had amigus shell and gave a little packet that normally is carried right here. It's a kind of a symbol of my relationship to nature. What they have in this little bag right here is a little amigus shell, and I'll explain that a little bit, and also some kinnikinick, Indian tobacco, and also a little piece of arborvita branch. That signifies everlasting life. See, you keep those three in this little packet and take it along as your link to the environment around you. And sometimes you will find, you know, that Indian people have this little medicine bag that they just fasten onto their belt or something like that. Some people say that it's kind of like hippie-like. See, but the Indian people have this bag for that purpose, you know, just to relate in. Well, anyway, a person who I talked to about this, and she was very kind again, and I just want to reemphasize that when one of your loved ones die, I'll tell you that I didn't get any kind of support like that ever in my life than when I got from these people, from my own people, that understood and come right up to and provided me with everything I needed. It's just a whole complete love kind of relationship, which was just absolutely great. Well, anyway, I get this little shell then that came in this little bag because they wanted to give this to me as a symbol of the love that we must be reminded that we're always surrounded with. See? So I got this little bag, and also I didn't get the weasel skin. So I jumped in my car and I was going off to the wake. And you know, from the Twin Cities to my home, which is Lac du Flambeau in northern Wisconsin, is quite a distance. It takes me about 4 or 5 hours to go there. I was driving along, you know, and thinking about all kinds of things, but, you know, foremost in my mind was my dad, you know. Now he's there. He's in a funeral home. Arrangements have not been developed. I didn't know what to do, you know, all questions like this. And I was driving along, and pretty soon the car ran out of gas. It was low. Man, I didn't realize. And so I was in a kind of a rural area. And pretty soon I saw this little old gas tank up there, and it looked as though it could work, you know. So I pulled up by the gas tank, and I was just kind of preoccupied with this whole whole cemetery thing, the death thing and everything, and I still didn't get a weasel skin. So I sat there, and this old guy comes out, and he says, what do you want? And I said, can you give me a fill? He's a regular. He said, oh, sure, he said. And so he started filling it up and stuff. And then I kind of looked up at the tree. There was a big tree hanging over like that. And I looked, there was a sign on the tree, and it was all faded out, and I could hardly see what it said. But it said the words, raw hides. This is right up in there, and I could hardly see it. And so when I got to pay, I paid him for the gas and so forth. And I said, say, listen, I said, I see this sign up here. It says raw hides. You wouldn't by any chance happen to have a weasel skin, would you? And the old guy says, oh, sure. He said, come on in back. And then I got out of the car and walked back in his shed behind. See, and we walked behind there, went back there, and there he had all kinds of hides. He deals in hides yet. And then he was telling me about his business, and then we got into that a little bit. It was good talking with him. And then I said, well, now, you know, my dad, you know, passed away, and we got to have a weasel skin. You know, we just got to have it. Oh, listen, he said, here we have three of them. Here, just take them, and you can have them. Just have them. Now, here was a non-Indian that picked up this weasel skin and just gave it to me. See? Well, you know, that's really something. But that was, you know, and I think pretty soon, you know, that it was really God's leading me right to that place, showing me this dumb sign. I would never have gotten it. Well, the story between that weasel skin and that amoeba shell is this, that when a person dies, there is a belief among Indian people that the soul, the spirit, is not really dead. See? There is a place where you want to go, but it is not quite there yet. So you have a wait period, so that you come and be with Joe, my dad. And during this time, this little amoeba shell, now I told a story last night of the amoeba shell. It was a shell, a huge shell that came out of the Atlantic Ocean, and it occurred at certain times in the history of the people. Well, they invert it in death, and it becomes a canoe. That's the imagery there. And this little shell was just that tiny. And so the shell has to be put by the body. See? And so the canoe contains the spirit. And Indian people believe that we're all on an island right now. And when you die, you cross over, see, to your journey's end. See? So that you cross over in this little amoeba shell, which ends up to be like a canoe. See? And it crosses over like so. Now you got to have a paddle or a motor. And since we don't have some of these commercial types, we have the weasel skin, see, which ends up to be the power that carries it across. So you have to have the weasel skin for the motor. See. So you place that by the body. And in the process then, there's another thing that you must know. During this wake period, people, you know, when people have a death of someone, you start crying all over the place, see. You know, there's tears all over, and there's mourning, and it's, you know, it's really bad. Well, the Indian people believe, you know, that if you shed one tear through this 40-day period, it'll flood the amoeba shell. You won't make it. So that during this time, there has to be tremendous support all the time during these 4 days. Now, during these 4 days, the old man counseled me, you've got to pull together your sandwiches. You get a whole stack of sandwiches so that anybody can come there and eat when they do this. They can eat and go and leave and whatever. Then you also ought to have 3 or 4 packets of cigarettes. Packets. Now, I don't smoke, but a lot of people do. And you take all the cigarettes out of the packs, you know, and lay them out on a table like that in a pile. So that, and then put plenty of ashtrays. So that during these 4 days, what you ought to do is to talk about the good times. And Joe is here. See, really, he is. Now, he was always full of fun, see, and he was always kind of joking anyway, see. Now, why do you have to be so sad? See, you know, and we talk about good times and right near the body. Now, you've got to be near the body all the time. And the older people during the day will help by being near. But during the night, they have to go to bed because they get tired. And you know what happens at night? All the teenagers come at night and they stay all night long. See, there's shifts. The whole family supports this, the whole experience of this wake period. Okay, then, see, at the end of the wake period, there's a celebration because, you see, this is when Joe has arrived. See? And during that time, they bring in the ceremonial drum. And this guy comes in from Neopit. He's a Chippewa Indian from Lac du Flambeau, but he married a Menominee Indian. And so they live in Neopit, in the Menominee Reservation. And so he goes over, he comes in from Neopit, and he's an older guy. And he has to carry a spittoon along, you know, because he never, now and then goes like that, and really, he scores pretty much, you know. And he comes in the door, you know, comes like this, and oh, ho, you know. It reminded me of Santa Claus. See? I had just gone through this period of wake, you know, this business, we were having a lot of fun, you know, and so forth, with the body. But he comes in just like Santa Claus, and he brings in his ceremonial drum. The ceremonial drum is all decorated around the side. Flower design. Heavy, all kinds of things. I told you last night about what the flower design means. See, and I wear it, see, and it's kind of symbolic. But he comes down, and he normally puts a kind of a blanket down below so it's protective of the drum. See, it's related to that respect again. And so he puts it down, and then he has to get rid of his chaw, you know, a little bit, and he gets it off. And everybody kind of silenced now, see. So he sits down, and then he finally gets done ho-hoing, you know, stuff like that. And then he starts his beat. But now this beat is something else. Now, I can't sing it because it's very complicated. And I hope at one point to pick up, you know, how to really sing that. And it's an extremely fast beat, it's real fast. And while he's doing this, he's going like this, see. Like so, see. It's a celebration. See? A joyful kind of thing. And at that point, there was 100 old people there. This was an Indian ceremony. At that point, you could cry. See. And you're not crying because of sad feelings. You're crying because of a joyful feeling. See. And you know, I was sitting here. You know, here I'm the oldest son. I felt like a king, you know. Wow, you know, I'm responsible. I'm the one that's most responsible for what's happening. And this friend of mine, Dave Careful, Everlasting Sky, sits by me. He gets up, and as this thing is going, he gets up and stands, almost like at attention, and he goes like this, see. And he does this just in respect, see. And you can't help it, because that music is, it really gets to you. And pretty soon I got up and started dancing like that, you know. And my mother started, you know, crying like ever, you know. I think she wished she was there, because that's where we all want to go. See, that's kind of a joyful feeling. That's it. But that relates to the spirituality of this thing. The other thing is the fact that this drum is part of the earth. See? This is an animal skin. And all animals, the four-footed, the two-footed, the birds, the fish, all life is represented by this drum. Because this is an animal skin that represents all those things. All the green things that grow is also part of the earth. So the earth is the second thing. The first thing was the spirit. The second thing was the earth. So that when you pound the drum, you now have an inspired message that you're singing about. And you're also pounding skin, which is part of the earth. And the third thing that's very important, of course, is the Indian people feel is family. Family is very important. Now, oftentimes we think of the family like, you know, your mother and father, or your children, you know, and then you include maybe an uncle or an aunt, or it's just very kind of close. Among the Indian people, they include the most distant possible people as part of their family. They also, it gets so enthusiastic that they include anybody else. It's kind of an extended family. And so that when you pound a drum, you are inspired with this vision. And you are also, in respect to the land, when you sing. See, you're pounding the drum. But also, thirdly, when you pound a drum, it gets to you. And it gets you out there, see. It's a social. So that maybe Saturday night, we'll have a chance to experience that socialness, see, a little bit. So that I just wanted to cite that. Now, so the drum is a, there's one more thing about it, and that it's a circle. And you talk about the circle of the sun. You talk about the circle that the earth is. You talk about the circle in regards to the four seasons, and also the circle in terms of the four directions, you know. The circle, completeness. There is no end to anything. So when you're talking about anything, like a friendship song that we're going to sing, we hope that we're singing it in, as a never-ending friendship. It is symbolic of that. So I want to teach that song now to three of you that have not done this before. So the Niji singers now will come up. Now, I want to just cite that, let me ask you, neither of you have ever sung this song? So first of all, I'm going to sing the song, and then you just hear it, and then I'll instruct you as to what we're going to try to do. Okay, now, here, these straps, normally there's a kind of a brace that hangs it up like this. Will you help by just kind of hanging it up and just a little bit, kind of even? Yeah, that. Okay. Now, when you do this, that's not really good. Okay, now I'll sing the song first, and then you kind of get on to it.
Oh.
that once again, three times. And when I say two, then we're in the two. And I'll just do this three, and then we'll be three. Okay? Get to you? This really gets your thing going a little bit. Okay. Now, I just want to talk to you a little bit about when I was very small, when I was before I was 8 years old. And again, I have to put myself into being a little boy, kind of. And maybe you can kind of imagine with me what it meant to be that little boy. This is in the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in northern Wisconsin. It's a very small town. In fact, it's about two blocks long. That's about all it is. It's got the post office there and a general store. And a few stores within the block that has that sell moccasins and things like that, kind of a tourist place. There's a couple bars in there. And they're just like a regular small town. But the village, the Lac du Flambeau village, was the Indian village about 5 miles around the lake, almost kind of on the other side of the lake. And the people that lived in the town were mostly white people that lived in the town, except in the kind of the suburb of Lac du Flambeau. We find several families that live kind of clustered close, but really that wasn't the central place. The central place was out in the village where the old ones lived. And there was a stretch of about 5-6 blocks there near the Flambeau River that dumped into Lake Flambeau, the Lake Flambeau at that time. And it went through a cement bridge that kind of was one of our favorite spots. And I lived perhaps closer to town, you know, in that side of the bridge, about a block away from the bridge. And me and my brother and my sister, Linda, my brother Billy, and we were the three children. There was a fourth child that was born in that home, and we called her Judy. And I was old enough to know that this was a baby, and I was old enough to know that she was my sister. I remember that much, you know, apart as far as my family's concerned. And we were very poor, you know, so poor in fact that oftentimes we didn't have food. You know, the food was given by the welfare or the Bureau of Indian Affairs agency and so forth. And so oftentimes we were so poor that we went hungry, really. And at that time, when my memory goes back, I think I can go back to about 5 years old. I don't know how much earlier than I can go back. You know, I was a little 5 year old kid getting hungry. Of course, I didn't know about all the political issues and anything. I just was a little five-year-old boy. As a matter of fact, I wasn't concerned about the problems of the world or even my own poverty. I didn't even care. You know, I just had myself a ball. You know, and But this my little sister came into the home, and I can remember, the outstanding thing I can remember is that she got sick, and she cried. And we would go and rock the thing, you know, and we would try to be very kind to the little baby and that kind of thing. She cried anyway. She cried. What she had was pneumonia. We weren't very close to the hospital facilities there. And we couldn't do much about it at that time. At that time, it was rather bad communication and transportation. And I remember 4 days of solid crying by that little baby. And within the week or so after she had been hit with pneumonia, she died. And as I was little, I could remember that. And I can remember all the different kinds of things my grandmother, who I was, you know, I really liked her. Her name is Sangwewe. That's what I said when I was 5 years old. A little later, I was to learn that Sangwewe really means Sangwewe Ash, which means strong heart woman. See, this is my grandmother. She had a little garden in back of the house, and she was the one who was trying to keep us all together. She was really the strong person. My dad was doing his hunting quite often, and you know, he was a hunter, as was his dad. And they were away quite a bit. And so I was more acquainted with my mother, and her name is Elsie Skye. And her Indian name is Benesique, Lady of Birds. And they would often talk in Indian, you know, right in the home. I can remember that. And they were talking about this and that from day to day and what they were going to do. And they would often play cribbage, play cards, you know, and that kind of thing at nighttime and so forth. But when this time came, we couldn't do anything about the death of this little girl. And I understood. You know, I was old enough to understand what had happened. And so we felt rather bad. In our home were 4 generations of people. It was a very poor place. You know, in fact, it was a wooden structure. It was all in one room. And the kitchen thing was here, and the pantry was right there. We didn't have any refrigerator. There was a stove here, and a corner here where you could sleep. But there was a stairway to a small attic, just a small attic above. And here we had the one table and a few chairs we had. And here we had the bigger bed over here. I normally slept over in that area. And as I remember, you know, coming in, that little place was really my home. And then outside, because I was such a kid, I used to remember my uncle. I call him Ikai. His name was Jim Skye. I couldn't even say Skye at that time. I knew him by Ikai, who was later killed over Korea. See, he's a jet pilot. He's an airplane pilot. And he was killed over, and then my mother later got a Purple Heart for it. But see, we remember that kind of thing. And some of the kinds of memories that come back in regards to those things. Now, sometimes we were able to talk about some of those white people that moved in and had those plush resorts right around the bend, see. And that was also another world. We never really interfered with that at all. We knew they were there. We wondered how they ever came to do that, you know, and have all that money and that kind of thing. But we never really concerned ourselves with that, it seemed. And although, you know, from time to time we would be so darn hungry that it would, you know. And then our clothes, we had just kind of one set of clothes and stuff like that. In fact, the welfare felt that we were so poor and that we were so neglected that they wanted to take us away from the home. And did that, essentially that, when I was about 8 years old. I always remember the day, say, when I was about 8 and a half or so. They called me in. I was playing with a Harold Potts across the street, across the road, up on the hill. They call me in, see, me and my brother Billy. We come running down, and we were wondering what's going on. And they said, well, this lady, and then they introduced me to Renetta Meyer, welfare department. She's a little lady, a nice person. This lady is going to take you out to a good meal. Of course, I'm interested. You know, suddenly a good meal. Boy, that's pretty good. But then in the process, then they dug out some shoes, brand new shoes, see? And a new pants and a new shirt. You know, gee, that's great. You know, I feel almost civilized, you know. And as a matter of fact, they told me to get in her car. My being the oldest, I will take the outside seat. Make Billy sit in the inside. So I shoved him in the middle, and here, because I always wanted to hang my arm off, because that was such a privilege. And so I immediately took my position of authority. And in the process, then, my mother, who knew what was going on at that time, came around the car. Now, she's not really that affectionate. She doesn't touch a lot. She's never done that. But this particular time, she comes and reaches over, and I was in my position of authority like that. She comes over and lays a smoocher right over there. A big, sloppy kiss. Now, I hadn't been kissed like that before, and I didn't know what I should do, you know. Shall I wipe it off now or later? There's my thoughts, you know. And I went 200 miles, I'm sure, before I dared to wipe it off, because I didn't know what that was all about. And I was pulled away from the home, and suddenly I was in this new place. And they described the fact that I won't be going back, that this is your new home, and these are your new parents, something to that effect. And my brother and Billy and I, you know, Billy started to cry. And I'm in control, so I said, hey, no, don't cry. I said, we'll be okay. We may not ever be able to get back to that place, but, you know, I was very brave. I was taking control and so forth and so on. So ever since that, for a few years, I had to take control. Every time he misbehaved, I had to bang him over the head. That's how I felt, like, you know, that kind of thing. But that was kind of like my background. During those early years, I had remembered so many times that sometimes, you know, Billy and I were mischievous. We were always into something. So quite often they would send us to bed, you know. And during the summertime, that was especially important when we're laying there in bed, you know, we don't want to be in bed, but here we are. And across the river, down the ways from that dam, which I described, is an old medicine ground, which is still there. The pine trees are huge, big, beautiful, straight pine trees. And it just kind of flakes out on top. And below that is just a bed of pine needles kind of all over. And in that area, it's a lot of sand. So that there's a lot of sandy areas right in the middle. And these pine trees happen to be kind of in a circle, kind of, like much this is. And it's kind of a natural God's place in a sense. I remember in my real early boyhood when Sangwewe and a number of other women would come down there during the summer. It's almost like, you know, you leave your house to go up to your cabin. Well, we left our little wooden house in the village. We'd walk up the medicine road, you know, and come up and see this little thing, and then they would erect their wigwams. It's almost like a summer camp, right along the river, right by the reeds, you know. And when I was real little, I used to go up by the wigwams and kind of look inside, you know, and then even crawl inside. Now, when I'm inside, the thing is kind of round, like a loaf of bread, kind of. And I would sit in there and kind of look in there, and then there would be grass matting around. And my grandmother would be sitting outside. She'd be talking in Indian, see, to some neighbors who also erected another one. And there's about five or six wigwams right in that area. They would be right along the river, and I would just sit in the wigwam and feel so kind of warm and cozy in there. And then I could also hear the muted calls of kids along the river. And then I could also, if I was very careful, I could hear what was being said by my grandmother, and they were visiting outside. See, it's kind of a neat kind of memory. And then I would crawl out and look at it, and, you know, it became part of me, see, that during the summer. I can remember that. But when we were sent home to bed, I could always remember those drums. Because right at that medicine ground, they used to dance right in that circle. Now, in those days, we didn't have money. We didn't have money enough for beads and stuff. And my brother Billy and I was, you know, we wanted to dance. We saw all those guys dancing around, you know, just going like this, and we wanted to take part, see. So we just had a plain shirt, like I often wear, just simply a plain shirt and just a plain pants. And what you ought to do is tie something on your arm. See, that's proper because that's at least something. So we would tie ribbons, colored ribbons up here, see, and let them hang down, see. And we're ready to dance now, see. And the old guys would be at the drum, singing their songs, you know, and everything. And I also remember part of that memory would be a stand over here that sold Red Pop. To this day, I love Red Pop. it's just, you know, strawberry pop, you know, it's just part of that whole thing. And I'd get out there and we'd always go around, you know, and dance. There, and sometimes a lot of custom people would come in there and do it. But as I understood it at that time, it was not for a show. It was not for a performance of any kind. This was an occasion for the entire village, and we all kind of got a dance in there, participate. The old ones, you know, their big stomachs like that, and then they went like that, you know, I can't pull my stomach out, but then they start dancing, and here's a father and a son come dancing around like that, you know, and the father would go like this, you know, like that, and then point to the son, and the son would go like that, you know. It was really pretty to see. Father and son, see? And they would be coming around, and all kinds of games are being played. There were some dances that had, you know, they were hunting for a deer, so their dances could go like this. See, they're looking for the tracks, and here's the deer over here. See, so they'd be kind of mimicking some of the things that they have in hunts, see, as such. Other memories too, in regards to the guy that lived by the bridge. They had a dirt floor. They didn't even have a regular floor. They had a dirt floor. But he would always be constantly out in front of his house whittling. He could whittle up a storm, you know, with his little jackknife. And he was the guy who showed me how to play mumbly peg. How many of you know how to play that? Mumbly peg. Take a little jackknife, flip it up like that, and let it stick. If it sticks, then you put it over here and then flip it up like this. And put it up here, and flip it up like that, put it up like that, and flip it up like that. Every time it's got a stick. See? Kind of a good, fun game. A lot of little games like that. Anyway, that's part of my thing. See? When I remember those things as a part of my style when I was little, now I want to shift into, I want to skip a lot of years now, and I'll tell you about something else. Now, I was put into this home, and through a lot of experiences, you know, and so forth, I finally finished high school, you know, that's the whole thing again, and finished college, you know, and that kind of thing, and had my thing with the service, and then got way back around, and I still didn't know who I was. I was in a non-Indian community now, and mainly in Minneapolis, and I got into Indian work at that time. And even at that time, I had lost myself. There were so many years that had been pulled from me that I could not find and deal with that joy that I had felt at one time when I was a little kid. And it wasn't until I finally got a position. I graduated at Luther College. Luther College in 1954 that I finally finished there. And in the process then, I had been maybe the only Indian person at Luther, and Luther really wasn't really geared up to serve Indians, I'm sure, you know, Luther College Decorah. But I finally finished, and when I finished, I really didn't know what to do. I ended up in work crews, in trimming trees, and hauling sod, and washing dishes, and stuff like that. I didn't care. It's all right with me, you know. Just so long as I got something, I got some food, you know. This is great, you know, this is really great. You can imagine some of these Indian people coming in from a city of poverty, and suddenly we find running water, heat, you know, and then some other people who don't even know the situation considers that you're living in poverty in Minneapolis. Well, it is poverty, but it was nothing like the poverty, it seemed, you know, that was really on reservation, and which still is there. So that this whole thing had happened. Now, I got into the home. And in the process, I ended up visiting. Now, I'll just tell you about a visit. I'm very open to suggestion. and they were going to train me to be a social worker. Social worker goes out and helps people. But now there are certain things that you must do in order to be a social worker, and one of the things you got to do is listen. See? So, and I say, well, what am I going to do? You know, go out there and listen? You know, kind of question like that. And so they said, well, go ahead. And these people are having a lot of trouble on North Minneapolis. If you go up there and talk to them a little bit and get to meet them, I think that's what you should do. There was a master social work counseling me to do this. So I take the bus, go across into North Minneapolis, knock on the door, and as I knock on the door isn't even latched and the darn thing swings open. And I kind of look around and I see what's happening. Kids were running all over the place. People were all over the place, and they didn't even care whether I was knocking or not. Finally, a little kid comes up to me and he said, you want to sit down? And then I said, sit down. So I sit down. See, and I didn't know what, you know, I was so green at that time, you wouldn't believe, you know. So I sat down, and I was wondering which one is the mother now, which is the father, which is the uncle, who is the grandma, who are the visitors, why is everybody in here? And as I was sitting down here, my instructions from the master social work person is that I'm supposed to just get into the house and listen. So I was here listening. And here, you know, I was noticing a lot of other people kind of sitting around. And here there was a social worker over here that had talked to the same guy. And she was there listening. Watch. I didn't find this out until finally, you know, the kids played and I poked them a little bit and we got him a little tumbling a little bit, you know, and wrestling a little bit, and I got into it a little bit. And then, who's your mom? Well, who's her mother here? Oh, she's out in the kitchen. Well, she was washing dishes and she just had a hard night the night before, apparently, and she wasn't really all there exactly. And I had to kind of talk to her a little bit and try to find out, you know, conditions and stuff like that. And I got to know, can you give me the names of the kids here? And then, of course, there's suspicion. Why do you want to know? And I said, you know, I'm from the Waite Neighborhood House. That's the South Minneapolis. What we're going to do is that we're going to find the Indian kids, get all their names, and we're going to start working with them. We're going to do all kinds of fun things. And I think that, you know, all these white people around and so forth, sometimes it's really hard for Indian kids to really take part. And maybe if we can start some activities, then I start explaining a little bit. And so they start, they're a little unsure. And then I say, you know, it's been a long time since I had a little fried bread. Do you ever fix fried bread here? And immediately, this old guy who's sitting on the opposite side, oh, fried bread, yeah. You should come over sometime, he says. And, you know, then I'm kind of scoring a little bit here. See, this guy responded to me. And in the process, yeah, I just love fried bread. And another thing I haven't tasted for some time is a piece of venison. Deer meat. Oh, man, you know, my stomach just really hurts just thinking about it. I was explaining. And then they got kind of into the conversation, you know. They were talking about venison and so forth. Hey, where are you from anyway? This is another question. Designed to find out, you know, well, are they from Leech Lake or White Earth or Red Lake or Net Lake or Grand Portage or, you know, where are they from? Or if you're from Red Lake, oh, you're from Red Lake. Hey, do you know such and such? You know, I know across the town there was another Red Laker up there. And we started talking about that, you know, so forth. And in the process, we started to put it together. And then we began to understand. I'm from Lac du Flambeau. Well, another kind, you know, is a Sioux person that I might visit. It's a totally different possibility. And then I'd be visiting something to that effect. And in the process then, in the process of talking to this family, I found that there was alcoholism in the family. I found that the man who was in charge of the family is unemployed. And he too was an alcoholic. And I also found that they were having trouble with their welfare worker. Welfare workers simply had no patience with this mess, which the welfare worker termed, because it was just a poor situation. I also found that a couple of the kids had been involved in some thievery in the community and had been pulled in to juvenile center and were faced with some kind of court thing. you know, within a week. And they were scared because they didn't want to lose their kids. And you see, they were already thinking about it, and they were scared, really scared. And I started talking about this, and I said, listen, I'm with this Wake Neighborhood House, and what I'd like to do is to work these things out with you. And I'll do just everything and anything. I'll come tomorrow, I'll do just anything. See, and we slowly pull this whole thing out. Now, in the process, I found that one of the girls had participated in Girl Scouts. And this church group had come in and had given a basket of food. And were relating to the mother. And these two boys that were adjudicated in the juvenile center had workers to work with them. And that the welfare department was also involved in this department with this family. And do you know that when I was through, I found 16 agencies trying to help that one family? 16 agencies. Neither one of them were coordinated. Neither one of them. So, you know, I saw that mess. So what I did on the phone and with the family and, you know, always, I began to coordinate. And I said, now we want to call a meeting. We want to call a meeting of all these agencies. We want to coordinate this whole thing so that we can help them better, so that this house doesn't seem like Grand Central Station. You know, this is not a way to make a living. You know, it's not a way to have a home. To have all these people just coming in there and sitting down and I'm looking at them, see? Which, you know, I was partly too. But, you know, we had to kind of pull that all together, you know, as such. And in the process, then, we ended up coordinating. And we assigned one worker. And if you're going to help those families at all, clear through that one worker. And we were able to work that out. Now, there were some well-intentioned things that happened too that were kind of bad as far as I was concerned. I started talking to churches. You know, I went out into churches and talked about the needs, the tremendous needs that these people had. There's about 6,000 Indian people in this one area, in an urban area. And I went out and talked to churches like that. The churches really just got hit right here. They wanted to respond. And the one thing that they do to respond in Minneapolis, maybe a lot of other places, is give the Indians your clothes. So this one person says, do they need clothes? And I just think of, you know, these people again. Yeah, they need clothes, all right. You know. So what happened? The word gets around. And somebody just simply volunteered this in the newspaper and told them to bring in the clothes to Larry Martin at the Wake Neighborhood House. Do you know that truckloads of the stuff came in? You know, truckloads of, I'll tell you, there were some very excellent clothes, but I'll tell you, there were some clothes that were just really fit to be thrown away. They were just really bad, and they were just piled. And a room, maybe a quarter the size of this thing here, was filled to the ceiling with clothes. Now, I'm the Indian worker serving 6,000 Indians. Now what do I do with this pile of clothes? See? So, and I couldn't get volunteers at that time. What we got to do is separate them. We got to weed them out and just keep the good stuff. We got to hang them up. Some of them are dirty. We got to wash them. See? And we got to do this whole thing. And it was a mess. So if you want to help the Indians and you're going to talk to me, please don't give me your old clothes. See? See, that's sad. But this was the kind of thing that was going on.